to the Fantastic Four, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. This is the podcast that combines comics, cocktails, and conversation for your listening pleasure. I am your host, Brett Young. And since I will not call him Frank, my guest this episode is Mr. Ward Hill Terry. Welcome to the Fantastic Lounge, Terry. How are you doing?
Oh, very well, Brett. I'm so glad to be here finally in the Fantastic Lounge. It's beautiful. I love it.
Well, let's get on with the show. So sometime ahead of recording each podcast, I ask my guests two things. Choose an alcohol, beverage, or ingredient that they enjoy, and choose a comic book character they love. Now, based on these answers, I come up with a cocktail for us to create, and I choose a comic book to discuss. So, Terry, please tell our friends in the lounge your chosen ingredient and comic book character. Let's start with your character.
The character is Nexus, created by Mike Baron and Steve Rude, originally published by Capital Comics out of Wisconsin, and then picked up from First Comics just outside of Chicago in the mid-1980s.
Very good. So Capital Comics was the first publisher. Is that so?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I had that off. I had First Comics as the first placer. So I have to mark that down. So I'm going to have a lot of questions about that. I will kind of ask off the bat, though. Why did you choose Nexus?
I chose Nexus because you helped me choose Nexus, Brett. Ever since you announced the show, I was hoping to be a guest on it. And so many characters, it'd be easy to choose a whole bunch of characters.
Sure.
But over the course of these several years that I've been listening to podcasts have taken over my listening life. And the vast majority of those podcasts are about comic books. So I listen to a lot of our friends on the Fire and Network podcast, and I listen to other friends in other countries talking about the same comics. And when you put the question to me, I realized it was the same comics. It's the same characters over and over. And we all love these characters.
Yeah.
But I was not hearing about a lot of the independent comics. And part of that is an age thing. I'm just a few years older than you and most everybody else on the network. But those few years in comic books always makes a big difference. If you look at any time frame in comics, if you're age, 10 in 1964, you start reading all these great Marvel comics. And, you know, by the time you're 18, all those creators you've been following, they're no longer doing Marvel comics. So you sort of give up. But your little brother, he starts reading them. And it's a whole new thing. So it's just a few years difference makes a big difference. So on all these podcasts I've been listening to, I've heard no one talk about First Comics or Capital Comics or Aardvark Vanaheim or Eclipse or Pacific. In all of these, this explosion of independent comics that came out in the late 70s and really exploded in the early 1980s when I was in college. So this is my prime comic book buying time. It's when I was exploring new things, getting past the superheroes, and wanting to try something new. So that's why I chose Nexus. Listeners, I gave Brett a choice of a whole bunch of these different publishers and titles to see what he knew, might know already. And he had one issue of Nexus. And
yes.
So that's how he chose this issue.
Yeah, pretty much. Exactly right. I had, when I was first going to a comic store that was in a farmer's market in the basement of a big mall in Lancaster, Pennsylvania called Park City Mall. I got to know the owner of the comic store really well, and I actually did basically kind of worked for my sang for my supper, so to speak. I would help him out like on Wednesdays and get like a certain amount of credit towards towards comic books and stuff. So I would see a lot of these characters as like comic book posters and stuff, and he would give me a lot of the old comic book posters. So I had them of various, you know, characters, and I had one of Nexus. And so one day, you know, Zara and I just picked up an issue. I don't remember when or how. It must have been in the back issue bin or something. And I think I just grabbed a few random ones. Like I had an E-Man comic and I had this and some other ones. They were always like really interesting characters. Like a lot of them looked very, like, you know, exotic or cool, you know, but I didn't know that much about them. So like I mentioned before, I'm going to have a lot of questions about Nexus as we go along. I did a little bit of research on him, but I didn't want to form a huge opinion. I wanted to kind of hear your end of the story, so to speak. So,
yeah.
Yeah. So,
you know, it's,
sorry, go ahead. No, go ahead.
Sort of what you're saying, it's hard to start something new, especially then these comics were more expensive than the typical Marvel and DC comics. And if you're already collecting,
yeah,
you have your regular pull list. And that's what's going to, you know, okay, I know I'm getting these 8 titles this week, and I really can't afford another title, especially one that costs maybe twice as much. So what's going to be sacrificed if I'm going to try something new? Or you get lucky like you did, just an issue falls in, or it's the right time. I remember with Nexus especially, I remember seeing, because it started out, the first 2, maybe 3 issues were black and white, almost magazine sized.
Oh, okay.
And on Saturdays, we could take the college van would take us into Boston for those who wanted to go. My college about 35 miles outside of Boston. So we go in and go to Newbury Comics before it was a chain. Newbury Comics was a comic book store. Then they got bigger and they opened up a record store across the street. So I was going to the old store, the original store. Oh, you old timers, remember that one? And they'd have all these exotic comics, you know, the independent comics, the British comics, all sorts of stuff I'd never even heard of. So then I had to start reading Comics Journal, it's Amazing Heroes and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But Nexus, I think I saw the black and whites like hanging on the wall. They're already collector's items right there.
Oh, okay.
And there's Steve Rude covers. And we're going to talk a lot about Steve Rude today, I have no doubt. And they're fascinating, absolutely fascinating. So it's long months of being fascinated by the design of the character, the quality of the art. And there is, what I think the final or the second to last issue from Capital had a big close-up of one of Nexus's friends, Judah, screaming, "I'm bored." And it was just hanging around on the stands for a very long time. I remember it was there all the time. And to myself, I'd see the cover that said, "I'm bored." And I'd say to myself, "I don't care. I don't know who you are. So what? You're bored." Much later, I did buy that comic as a back issue and realized how that cover was funny. But
yeah,
for non-reader, it's not a grabber. That's a different thing to talk about.
Yeah.
But so when First Comics got permission to start publishing Nexus, and I was all on board with First Comics, that came at the perfect time for me to start buying something new. They were doing E-Man and Warp. There's another comic. Someone should do a podcast about Warp. Science fiction play that was made into a comic. And so the Badger and American Flag. Loved American Flag.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when they started publishing Nexus, that was the perfect jumping on point. So
were they doing Grimjack? Was it Grimjack and Scout? So the Tim Truman stuff? Yeah, they were doing that too. That's
they
right.
had a great line of stuff.
Yeah. Well, listen, we're going to talk about a lot more about him as we go, but I also wanted to get into your beverage of choice. So why don't you let us know what that was as well?
It's gin.
And why gin?
Well, I like gin. since I started drinking, because I'm sort of the anti, who is our friend in Arizona, with the one
Sean Ross.
Sean Ross.
Yeah.
Sean was drinking for me when he was younger, when I was drinking. So when I started drinking, I like the whiskeys. You've done a lot already with whiskey in your last show with Ryan, with the bourbon.
Yes.
Oh boy, that sounded good. I haven't made that one yet.
You should try it.
Yes, I will, because it's terrific. I love bourbon. I love whiskeys, Irish whiskey, Scotch, but I also like gin. And part of that might be a little bit of reminiscent when my parents would have cocktail parties back in the 60s and 70s.
Mm-hmm.
That smell of the juniper lingered. And I like that smell. I never tried the stuff, but I like the smell. And a bunch of years ago, my daughter's school was raising funds by selling spices. So I bought some juniper and made my own gin.
How were you making it? Like, what were you, just in jars, or like, what were you making?
found a recipe and got a big jar and some neutral spirits and a whole bunch of juniper, and experimenting with florals, my lilac bushes and some other things, just to see if I get a different flavor profile.
Very cool.
They came out very nice. I had one come out not so nice, but.
Well, that's the trial and error, that stuff. Yeah. So you had your own, you basically had your own still, basically. So, Rob Kelly would be very jealous.
I wish I had a still. I'd love to learn that. I was getting a neutral spirit to start with and just infusing the spirit.
Yeah. Well, that's the much easier way to go and the quicker way to go for certain, because gin does not take long to make, which is nice.
No.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to go over a recipe that we made with gin. But first, I wanted to talk a little bit more about the origin of gin, a segment I like to call
Secret Origins, which is the most wonderful phrase ever created, and it needs no further explanation. Because let's get right to it, Brett. It's no secret. I want you to pour a gin.
Oh, very good. Very good. I love that. Okay, well, thank you, beefeatergin.com and liquor.com for this research. Here we go. Gin's origin dates back to the Middle Ages. Humankind has long known about the healing properties of juniper. The Romans burned juniper branches for purification, and the doctors stuffed their masks with juniper berries to protect them from the Black Plague. In the 11th century, southern Italian monks used a still to produce alcoholic tonics from wine infused with juniper berries. It was used for medicinal purposes, but it was the first example of alcohol being infused with juniper. In the 17th century, Dutch physician Franciscus Sylvius is often recognized as inventing gin. At this point, it was a variation of the tonic the monks had made centuries earlier. Sylvius produced a schnapps with juniper berries, which was used as a medical elixir. Now, we knew the English would have to get in here somewhere. So later in the 17th century, Queen Elizabeth I had sent British soldiers to help the Dutch in their War of Independence. It was there that they were first introduced to the Genever spirit. The English brought the spirit back and after the war made it their own. In early 18th century London, gin had become very popular as French brandy, beer, and wine were heavily taxed. There was little regulation on producing gin and the gin craze began. Hundreds of gin distilleries started popping up all over London and England as a whole. Londoners were drinking gin as fast as they could make it, leading to an increase in crime, poverty, general debauchery, and vicious hangovers. The English government became the party poopers and passed the Gin Acts of 1729 and 1736 to curb the production. However, these acts created the underground illegal production of far less safe gins, as we've all probably heard of bathtub gins, stuff like that. In 1751, the English government passed a new gin act, which stopped gin distillers from selling to unlicensed merchants and restricted retail licenses. This successfully reduced England's consumption of spirits. Gin prices went up as the quality improved, and it was viewed as much more respectable drink. Now, here's a couple fun facts about gin. What you just talked about. To create gin, you have to have at least three ingredients. Those would be alcohol, usually a fermented and distilled spirit made from grain, a neutral spirit, as you mentioned, water, and juniper. In order to be classified as gin, juniper must be added. Here's a question. Can you guess the country that consumes the most gin?
Currently?
Yes.
I'll avoid the obvious, and I'll say Australia.
I was going to say, if you got this, I would try to sign over the rights to the Fire and Water Podcast Network, where I have no authority to do that. But the Philippines are actually the biggest consumer of gin. Yes, I know. I would never have guessed that in a million years. And another note, the gimlet, a gin drink made with gin and lime juice, was created to combat scurvy in the Royal Navy. So there are some fun facts about gin. So. Terry, it's happy hour.
Yeah.
So let's make a drink. I call this Killer Poodle, which will make more sense when we read our story. But Terry, why don't you tell our friends what we need?
For the Killer Poodle, you need gin. You need some simple syrup, some tonic water. You need lime juice. And now this is where Brett makes it his own. You need some mint and cucumber.
Okay, and so basically how you're going to make this cocktail. In a cocktail shaker, you're going to muddle the three slices of cucumber, the mint, and the simple syrup until the cucumber offers no more resistance. And you'll know when you're muddling, you'll hear that kind of crunch and stuff like that. Once it gets a little more quiet, you'll know to stop. Then you fill the shaker with ice and pour in the lime juice and the gin. You want to do about a half ounce of lime juice, even a little less, quarter to a half ounce of lime juice, and 2 ounces of gin. You want to shake until the cocktail is thoroughly chilled, about 20, 30 seconds I usually do. That gives it a really good shake. Then strain the mixture over ice into a Collins or rocks glass. Then you want to top that with tonic water and garnish with a sprig of mint and a cucumber slice if you'd like. So Terry and I are going to try our Killer Poodle cocktails, and you can all drink along and enjoy this promo break.
Grab your bat microphone. It's time to start the show.
Welcome to the Bat Pod, a Batman comic book discussion podcast.
What are you doing? That's my line.
I'm starting the show. I was waiting on you. We're starting the show.
I'm the one that says that. You're my new co-host, where we talk about back issues of Batman, could be in Detective Comics, World Finest.
Could we do some Shadow of the Bat and maybe some Nightwing, maybe some Batgirl?
Absolutely.
Can we also define where my co-hosting parameters start and end? I can't start the show, but I can definitely co-host it.
Well, maybe we'll let you start the show.
Okay, at least I get to pick one of the books we're covering on each episode, and you can pick the other?
Absolutely.
Can I close out the show? Can I bring friends? Will there be snacks?
What is your favorite bat snack?
Cucumber sandwiches.
Join Bill Beer and J. David Weider every 2 weeks on the Bat Pod. You can find us on your favorite podcast app.
Grab your headphones, listen up. You know you love it. Drop the facade. Like the Dark Knight Detective, they've got some perspective. They're a pure crime-fighting collective. It's the Bat Pod.
And we are back. I tried to get Terry to try my new bathtub gin, but for some reason he said no. I mean, I just bathed in it. I know it's clean. I don't know what the problem is, but anyway.
That Philadelphia Eagles water, man. I can't drink that stuff.
But the water's the best part. What are you talking about?
Your Wawa water.
That's right. That's how you make a good hoagie. You got to have the water. All right. Well, now that we've had a chance to taste our Killer Poodle, Terry, what'd you think?
Oh, that is delicious. I was a bit skeptical about the cucumber slice, but I like cucumber, but I never think of it as something for as part of the mixer.
Mm-hmm.
And even though I was slicing it kind of thin, because that's the thing. When you say slice a cucumber, it's not a real measurement, but I wanted something easy to muddle.
Right.
I like how precise you were. Three slices. I think that's absolutely right, because it's not overwhelming. And I do like lime juice a lot. I like a lime drink. And we tried it earlier with more lime juice, and you're right. Cutting back the lime juice.
Yeah.
It's more cucumber forward for really so little cucumber.
Mm-hmm.
But the mint is bringing – I got fresh mint from the backyard.
Very good. Very
cucumber
good.
From across the street. My neighbor brought some cucumbers over. But I've been really resistant because I made this – before we started talking, and I've been waiting to drink it, and now I can drink it.
Well, very good. I'm glad you enjoy it because cucumber is, you're right. It's sort of like not something you'd think about all that much with alcohol. What can I ask? What kind of gin you use?
Oh God, it's a London dry gin. I think it might be Beefeater.
Okay.
The green bottle.
Right. I used
the cheapest, but not the most expensive either.
Right. No, Beefeater is great. It is a good London dry gin. I use a London dry gin that actually has some cucumber infusion, and it's called Hendrix. If you've heard of that one, it comes in sort of this kind of fat cylindrical bottle. So like a black bottle.
Hendrix bottle is really distinctive.
Yeah. So I use that, and it makes everything sort of – it helps everything sort of pop. But, yeah, mm-hmm. with the mint and cucumber and the lime and the gin, and the tonic finishes it off well. So you kind of have this infusion of all these different flavors, and they mix well. And, again, we're getting towards – you know, we're recording the week after Labor Day weekend.
It's still summertime.
Yeah, it's still technically summer.
This is a great summer drink. You sent the recipe, I tried it, and my wife tried it, and she's quite discerning, and she had great praise for it.
Good. Well, I'm glad she enjoyed it. That's good to hear. That's the point. Yeah, this is a nice, you know, summer sip and drink. You know, you can sit out on your veranda, you know, if you'd like, and enjoy this and read your Nexus comics. it's a really nice, refreshing and a way to finish off the summer before we go into the fall and get to some heavier drinks. So. Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. I'm glad your wife enjoyed it. My wife enjoyed it, too. I made one for her earlier before we started recording. She's always my taste tester. I always give it to her first, and she makes sure I get the thumbs up.
Good.
Yeah, she hears the shaker, and she'll just come running down the stairs. While we enjoy our killer poodle in the Fantastic Lounge, how about some fine literature?
This.
The comic we'll be discussing that involves Nexus is Nexus Issue 9, publisher First Comics. Cover date, June 1985. On sale date, February 7th, 1985. Cover price, $1.75. A lot of fives in there. Titled Teen Angel, 24 pages, written by Mike Barron, penciler Steve Rood. Inker letter is Eric Schanauer. Colorist, Les Dorshield. Dorshide. Editor, Rick Oliver, and the cover artist, the amazing Steve Rude. So thank you, Mike's Amazing World of Comics, for that recap. Ward Hill Terry, would you like to tell our friends in the Fantastic Lounge what this story is all about?
Nexus returns to find Ilum in the grip of election madness. Tyrone has won by a landslide. Nexus catches up with Sundra Peel for some adult activities. Later, Tyrone orders Nexus archaeological digs nationalized. Nexus orders the archaeological team out of the area with a powerful shock blast as an incentive. He then suddenly collapses. Tyrone, ignoring his advisor's political counsel, saves Nexus, getting him to the tank. After a soak, Nexus emerges with a new mission. The mission takes him to Earth to kill a 14-year-old mass murderer named Teen Angel, leader of the Killer Poodles. In an interlude, an ambassador returns home to her two babies swimming in a rather familiar tank. While having dinner with a talking alligator, Nexus finds Teen Angel posing as a busboy and blasts him. The mission is complete at the cost of any remaining goodwill he had left on Earth. He leaves, taking Tony, a member of Teen Angel's street gang, with him.
All right. Thank you very much. So what did you think of the issue overall?
Overall, I loved it. I loved it. And I'm curious your reaction, too, because similar to you, this is sort of my first issue. The previous two issues were sort of out of continuity issues. They were it was a crossover with the Badger.
Oh, okay.
So Nexus and his friend Judah were sort of shipwrecked in this called a bowl-shaped world, where they had several adventures with Badger. So those are the now I'm getting my chronology confused. But those are the first issue I bought was the team up. The first comic was not part of the regular ongoing plots of Nexus. It was just these independent adventure happening on this other world. And I remember one of the captions said they have many adventures over many months.
Okay.
So that left room. In fact, a couple of years later, Barron went back to that plot with special guest artist Keith Giffen and did another story of what happened on that world.
Oh.
So in this story, Nexus is going back to Ilum. So this is the first time me, as a new reader, saw Nexus world Ilum, which, for if you've not read Nexus, it's spelled Y-L-U-M, and it's sort of short for asylum, because the Ilum, the world, is an asylum for all sorts of people from all over the galaxy, mm-hmm. probably from all over many galaxies, who for some reason or other need a refuge, and Nexus has created a world for them. So this is my first introduction to Sundra, to Dave, to the tank, to his mission. And so to Tyrone. So I thought it was a very good way to introduce that. I was able to understand the interpersonal relationships of the characters in the book very easily. What about you? What was your reaction when you read it?
Well, like I said, this is the first and only issue I have of Nexus. And I read it at the time, you know, I bought it, but that was years and years ago. So pulling this out and rereading it was a lot of fun, because it had sort of a nostalgic feel, because it had that feel of like when you went to the newsstand and you just grabbed a random issue or something, you were sort of dropped in the middle of it. Now, this was actually a fairly good jumping on point, because I guess it was sort of the new, he had just finished the other mission, was just coming back to Island. So you kind of are sort of reintroduced, I guess, to some characters that he's familiar with. And it was just an interesting place to start. So I kind of had to, I read it a couple times because I wanted to sort of figure out what everything was. And I really liked it. Like, so to start, like, what did you think of the, what'd you think of the cover?
The cover's great. It's a painted cover.
Mm-hmm.
Why isn't Steve Rude just talked about all the time? Maybe because his output is just so limited, because his quality is so good.
Yes.
He's not someone who could crank out, 50 pages a month ever.
Right.
So it's just, it's kind of a weird cover, but it's also a captivating cover. Right in the immediate foreground is a very young-looking kid with a maniacal look and a huge mouth, kind of Joker-esque before that character was really overused.
Mm-hmm.
And he's holding a deliberately bent or curved sort of dagger with a serrated edge. And he's got that in his left hand, and his right hand is grasping his left wrist.
Mm-hmm.
He just gets this look of gleeful psychosis on his face. Behind him is a young girl lighting up a cigarette. So she is being lit by the flame to her cigarette, which is absolutely beautiful, the lighting source there.
I know. It's so good.
On the right side of the page is another youth holding some sort of weapon with his two hands. Mm-hmm. And he's getting really exaggerated, almost like a flock of seagulls.
Yes.
And I just noticed he has his initials shaved into the stubble on top of his skull, and another rotten-looking kid behind him. And above it all, Nexus is standing in a window, a big aperture in the door, with light beaming from behind him as he glares down at these hooligans. Well, they're murderers, they're not hooligans.
Yeah, it's sort of exposing this underbelly of society to the light is kind of what Nexus is doing here. It's a great cover. It so much emotion. You're right. The kid's eyes, it's just fascinating and horrifying, and you can see the madness in it. And him grasping his wrist, it's almost like he's the kid. It's almost like he's trying to control his own, madness or rage, like he's like, no, I don't want to kill yet. Give it a minute, then I'm ready. Yeah. And has no idea what's waiting behind him.
But part of the thing about Steve Root, and once we decided to do this book, and I read this book, I immediately had to read the next book. And then I said, wait a minute, I'm going back and read all the runs before this. And then I just read 20 plus issues of Nexus. I got to get back to it. So I devoured it all at once. I haven't read it in so long, and it holds up so well. And looking at it now with a more experienced eye, the detail of the design that Steve Rude puts into not just characters, but their clothes, their backgrounds, the machines they use, where they live.
Yes.
Everything is so deliberate. This knife this kid is holding, mostly the hilt is under his hand, just a bit sticking out. And Root has taken the time to illustrate that this is a ridged hilt. We see exactly two ridges.
Mm-hmm.
On the other end of the hilt where the blade is, it's not just, I forget what that's called. Is that the pommel?
I think so. We'll go with that. Somebody will correct us if we're wrong.
It's spiky. There's two spikes pointing out in the same direction as the knife. Yeah. And in between, there's a lovely decorative element.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't need to put it. It could have been just a flat piece, but he puts a decorative element in. And the blade, you have to imagine a knife blade sticking out of the hilt and then bending, the flat bending away and then bending out again.
Mm-hmm.
So the blade is sort of, I don't know, how would you describe that?
It almost reminds me of like it was like one of the saws that you use to like that are long and sort of floppy that's what it almost looks like if you just glance at it, because it has a curvature to it. It's not like a It's not like one curve. It's just sort of like it curves scimitar. Down and then back up.
Yeah.
And then at the end, at the last like third of the knife has the serrated edge.
Yeah, that would do a lot of damage.
Yes. Yes, it would. Yeah.
Because it's almost like if it penetrated flesh, the handle of the knife, which probably would stick into the flesh as well.
Yes.
Looks like it would be about an inch and a half from the initial stab wound.
Yes, that's true. Yes, that's true. And then the serrated, when the knife's coming out, would be more damage. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's a horrible looking weapon.
Yeah, don't get those for your kids. That's a little personal advice. Well, let's again, gorgeous cover. I think we both agree with that. So, what about the overall story or the story itself? Like, so I, you know, like I said, this was sort of me kind of, I'm trying to catch up on things as I go. And I had some questions I'm going to ask you kind of along the way, but it seemed like a good intro to Nexus for me, actually, or somebody had never heard of him. But reading this a couple times, I had some thoughts, like at some points I was like, well, is he the bad guy? You know, because he's again, I don't know that much about him yet, but he's very complex because he does some heroic things. But then he does some terrible things as well. I guess at least on the surface. I mean, he basically murders this boy.
He's a murderer.
He kills him. So the tank was the part I didn't quite understand, and I read up a little bit of it. But maybe you could explain a little bit more about like what are Nexus's actual powers? Like what's his mission? What's his what's the point of Nexus?
You have hit upon it exactly. It is. The Nexus, the character, Horatio, the character, mm-hmm. part of what drives this book, what I find it compelling, is his inner conflict. Because he knows what he's doing, he's murdering. Yep. But he's murdering murderers, but he's still murdering. And so he is conflicted with this. The tank is where he goes for healing and where he learns what he needs to do next. And over the course of the series, Baron really explores this. He tries, not long after this story, to stop the dreams. And it's a very fat Elvis Presley story arc. Nexus is taking a lot of drugs. He's hanging out with a lot of skeevy people who are taking advantage of him. So he won't dream. So he won't have to do this. But not only he is compelled to do it, he is made to do it by the entity that sort of created the world on which he lives. So I don't know exactly how Nexus got to where how Horatio got to where he is, how he gets to Ilum, where he finds the tank and the character called the Merc, who gives him his powers. But he does, and now if he doesn't do it, he'll die. The headaches are so bad when he doesn't act on them. He doesn't choose who he's going to avenge. The dreams tell him. That's why in this issue, it's Teen Angel.
Right.
I mean, and when he goes off, one of the Tyrone, I think, says, you know, he's only 33. That's barely doesn't qualify. Because in the first story, he goes after a slaver named Clausius. That story sort of continues over many issues. A terrible excuse for a being. He's an outer space character. This is another thing that's going on in the world of Nexus. Clausius would enslave people by cutting off their heads and keeping the heads alive. So the latent psionic power in the head would control massive things, war machines, and all sorts of things. So that's how Clausius made his business. He'd kidnap a bunch of people or buy a bunch of people and cut their heads off and then sell the heads as this energy source. Nexus frees them. And so at the end of the book, you see a couple of heads flying around. The heads have their own home world right next to Ilum, and they're an important part of.
Oh, so yeah. Okay, so that explains the people that were just flying by with heads in this. Okay, very good. So I didn't know that part. Because they're wearing like they're kind of like speeding by with they have goggles on or something like that.
They have massive telekinetic powers because all they have is a head.
Right. It's so funny.
So that's it. So Nexus has to do this stuff. In the meantime, he's trying to live in peace on Ilum with all these people, like the heads that he's rescued, all these other people who found asylum there. Mm-hmm. I don't know where he found Tyrone, but Tyrone's a great continuing character.
Yeah. And yeah, because he's a little complex too. Because you kind of think at first he's like, okay, he's just some skeevy politician, mm-hmm. and he's out for himself. But he saves Nexus. At one point he goes to tell, and that this is kind of the other interesting point too, is he wants to. I guess Nexus owns these archaeological digs,
right?
And he wants Tyrone, now president, wants to nationalize these or be able, like, for all the people have access to this, or the government to have access to this. And Nexus refuses, and not just refuses, but like kind of blasts them all. You know, doesn't kill them, but sort of shocks them, kind of an indignity, especially considering this guy is supposed to be the president.
Right. And Nexus is, it's essentially, that's his backyard. Those are his digs. It's his planet. He found the place.
Oh, okay.
That
okay.
Part of it too, you know?
Okay. That part I didn't quite, understand his sort of ownership of these. But anyway, but he sort of, brusquely, blasts these guys away. And then immediately after that has one of these attacks you're talking about, one of these massive headaches. And one of Tyrone's council members, or one of his council, just basically says, well, just leave him there. You get rid of your biggest headache. And he's like, no, he's a citizen of Isla. And thank you for pronouncing it Ilum. Otherwise, it would have been here calling it Yalum or something like that. But no, he's a citizen, and he gets him to the tank and saves his life.
Yeah, this word look at it, he's a real politician. He said, what's mm-hmm. good for my candidate, my party, my team, not what's the right thing to do?
Right, exactly.
This may be a hard concept for you, but you've read a lot of fiction, Brett. You can probably imagine that. There may be politicians who think, what's best for my candidate?
Yeah, well, listen. I live right outside of Washington, D.C., and it's all sunshine and rainbows around here. So I'm not really sure what you're talking about, Terry. But
there's probably some old propaganda you can read from some other nation.
Sure, yes, I imagine, yeah.
So yeah, this tank has remarkable healing powers, and other people, beings, have been able to use it in other stories.
Gotcha.
But me too, as a new reader, we could see mm-hmm. the tank was distinct. So when we see mm-hmm. the same shape tank in another place in the story, we connect to that. Oh, this must be the same kind of thing.
So later in the story, I mean, we can jump ahead to that. Later in the story, there's a sort of an interlude with she's an ambassador. Is that what she is? And again, this is a new character I was unfamiliar with. And she goes to visit she gets home, and her children are with a nursemaid. And they're both these twin babies are floating in a tank, very similar. So obviously there's probably an obvious connection between these children and Nexus. Yeah.
That's an ambassador from Earth to Isla. Her name is Ursula. And if you refer, this took, reading all the back issues and catching up. So Baron does a great job. The editor does, without excessive footnotes, and giving us enough to keep it going. And if you take the time, I think you'll find where the things go. So on the page where Nexus is in bed with his girlfriend, Sundra, she asks, what do you think Ursula was doing here? Because she was on Ilum when Nexus was away. Because Ursula not only is an ambassador from Earth, she is a spy from Earth. They are trying to take over and find the source of Nexus power. It's a lot of these stories are about energy sources. Another thing I know you may have trouble understanding in our world of limitless energy.
Exactly.
So the Earth was actively trying to figure out a way to subvert or acquire Nexus power.
Okay.
So Ursula was sent there. She did terrible things, including raping Nexus.
Oh,
he doesn't know that.
Is this like a Talia al Ghul situation with Batman? Oh. Is it sort of like that?
This was handled better.
Okay.
He doesn't know that he's a father. He finds out later.
Gotcha. Okay.
So that this things are tying it. Ursula is a villain, but she does not always. And and Sundra used to work with her in the spy agency on Earth. All these great stories come gently. A little bit at a time, you find more and more backstory of everybody, and it's wonderful.
Very cool. Your love for the series is palpable, which is just fantastic, and I love learning all these things because it's very unique. This is not your typical superhero, if you want to use that term for him.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because it is about first of all, let's face it. It's a comic book. It's about fantastic things toys, fantastic beings, fantastic powers, all the and action. But at the heart of this story is the conflict of the central character, who is forced to do terrible things that he knows are terrible, and he cannot stop him. He cannot not do them.
And this is like I can't wait any longer. The Steve Rude's art in this is just so cool.
Oh my god!
Was this coming out monthly or bi-monthly? How often was this Comic Con? Do you have any recollection of that? I don't know. Like
if it was... in this year, right? No, I think it was monthly.
Was it really? Wow!
I imagine, is it
the work done on these plus the painted covers? I mean,
yeah,
this world, the world is so fleshed out. Ilum, and especially, and then when they're on Earth.
And Earth is also
it's so unique and creative and all the different creatures, the two frog tourists riding around in their little water tank things that the psycho kid drops magnesium tablets into prize them.
Yeah. Did you catch the names of those creatures?
I don't remember. What are they?
Bert and Jaime. The Hernandez brothers.
Oh, interesting.
And at the first page, first story page after the splash, Nexus is hitched a ride back to Ilum in a spacecraft, and the captain of that ship is named Tottlebon, named for Steve Tottlebon, the artist on Swamp Thing.
Very good. Very cool. Yeah, I could see this being chock full of references and stuff like that. You see, but like even like the when the kids, when you finally see the killer poodles, and all these kids look like they're like, you know, anywhere between, God, I don't know, 10 and 15, maybe. Yeah. And they're all sort of dressed similar but uniquely.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just it's just so good. And the angles he takes and the there's such liveliness to his art and flow. He doesn't use the typical posing or the typical even the typical layout, but everything just flows so well and so interesting. That's the thing, that's like his angles, his art is just on top of everything else. It's just very interesting to look at.
Yes.
You can
page by page, panel by panel, the depth, the solidity of the line, just, it's absolutely fantastic. The little details of industry and ordinary objects that he bothers to put in to make it look familiar as to what it ought to be. And still unique is that it's exotic and futuristic.
Even like the traffic jam.
Yeah.
So the kid gets away and he goes into a traffic jam. All the cars are cars. The flying vehicles in the traffic jam.
But they're flying on the same plane.
Yes. Yeah. They all have to be at the same level because you keep thinking, like, why doesn't one of them go like 10 feet higher?
I get it because it's the joke. And
absolutely. But the unique angle, like, you know, you see the overhead shot, you see the behind shot,
to establish it.
Yeah. The alligator guy being so put upon and him throwing his head back and stuff like that.
He's a lizigator.
Oh, a lizigator. Okay.
Lizigator. His name is Clone Zone. He's a professional hilariator.
Yeah, he said, because that's right, because he tries to bribe the police officer with tickets, right, to a show or something like that. Yeah.
Clone Zone was introduced in a few issues earlier when it was still published by Capital Comics. Mm-hmm. He's obviously the comic relief. He's a comedian. He's a cheap comedian. But he's kind of funny. And not long after this issue, he got his own backup strip in Nexus.
Oh, okay.
Mike Barrett.
Yeah, I can see that being a lot of fun. But even in the restaurant they're at, from the outside to the interior, you know, all the everything going on around them.
Even the idea of the restaurant. The restaurant is called Eat the Monument. And Clone Zone is saying, "Whack, they did it to me again. I ordered the Kremlin, and they brought me the Corn Palace."
Yeah.
And on his dish is this architectural rendering of some building. Someone else is eating a Sphinx, and it looks like a pyramid in Stonehenge. I don't know how those two flavors go together.
I don't know how. I can't even imagine what the stuff would taste like. But I guess it's okay. I don't know.
Even the dishes, you know, has put a little bit of detail in it to show that this is, it's not. He's not just drawing concentric circles here.
No,
he's designed everything. As if he knows, if you opened up a drawer, he would know what's in there, what it looks like.
I know. It's incredible. I mean, you have artists who can make places look lived in, and then you have artists who can make things look lived in. And this is above and beyond.
Like, you know, Brett, I just noticed this.
Yeah.
We talked earlier about when Ursula returns to Earth,
mm-hmm.
and to her babies.
Right.
There's a nursemaid there. I just noticed now the nursemaid has a weapon on her belt, on her hip. Yes.
Oh, you're right. You can see it when she's like folding the towels. You can see it like a little holster.
Her last piece of dialogue is she was complaining. Oh, Ursula says, please prepare the castle for a full inspection. Derek was missing a button when I arrived. And the nurse responds, he will be disciplined, madam.
Oh, and she's sort of hiking up her belt a little bit.
So this, they don't fool around here.
No. Wow. Keep it. Make sure your buttons are good. Jeez.
If you, the more you look, the more you see.
Wow. Yeah, you're right. And that's the thing. That's why, like, I read this and I was like, wait, I got to go back and read it again.
Mm-hmm.
And Steve Root is one of those guys. And there are artists like this who you can just stare. You don't even need any lettering. You don't need any words. You can just stare. He did a three-part World's Finest, like, prestige format series. It was just it was three issues, kind of like Extra Life. You know, when DC, and I think it was like in the 90s, were doing all those prestige format things with their really expensive paper and everything. They're doing a lot of Elseworld stuff with it and everything. If you ever find this, it is gorgeous. It's a real classic plot of Superman and Batman taking on Lex Luthor and the Joker. And it's wonderful. And they show the different dichotomies between, you know, Superman and Batman and Luthor and the Joker. And it's gorgeous. And again, it's one of those that you can just stare at for hours and see all these little things. And part of it takes place during Christmas. And it's so wonderful. But getting back to this, yeah, the art, and then when the killer teen angel poses as a busboy to come in there to try to get Nexus, and he recognizes him and then just blasts him. But just the, even though the kid, you know, you see the kid freak out and you see the multiple panels of him realizing who it is, reaching for the gun and everything before Nexus blasts him back, and then before he kills him, as he's running away, he shoots him in the back.
Yes.
You know, Nexus, you know, murders this kid from behind.
Then the setup to that, Brett just explained there, has the kid draws his weapon and gets zapped by Nexus, not incapacitated. Mm-hmm. But then Nexus is revealed to all the people in the restaurant as Nexus. He had been, you know, essentially in his secret identity before. Yeah. Now he's standing there in his cool blue and black with the lightning bolt over his left shoulder and his really cool red goggles.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody in the restaurant says, good God, Nexus. It's Nexus. He shot that boy. Somebody call the police. So then everybody, and the kid starts, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to get you the wrong order. So he gets the crowd sympathy instantly. And so the kid, Keen Angel, starts to run away. He ducks behind a guy, and Nexus sends out a blast that goes around
him,
the guy and kills Teen Angel. So, yeah, that's what people see. He just sees Nexus kill a kid who looked like he was crying and looked like he was innocent.
Yeah, it's, and so you may know the answer to this. I don't know. When Nexus is, when he sees one of these guys, sort of his, it's not programming, but his mission, is it sort of override anything else? Or does he just not care? I mean, because obviously, he could have grabbed the kid and flown off or something like that, you know, and dealt with it somewhere else.
At that point, does he
just, like, when he has his chance, he just takes it and that's it?
I think so. I think he has to do, you know, Brett, it's hard to say because there's another story. You know, and this could be the part of the Nexus evolution. Maybe Baron designed it this way. This is still early on.
Yeah.
This is issue number 9. Issues 7 and 8, and maybe 6, 7, 8 were a separate story entirely. So then we only have 5 issues to start to establish who he is and what he does and why he does it. Another mass murderer he has to get. He takes his time because he wants to know who this fellow is, because there's a personal connection to his father.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very dialogue heavy story, but Mike Baron can do that well, and Steve Root can illustrate, you know, two people talking. Yeah. And it's fascinating. So the victim, Nexus tells him who he is, and the victim knows who he is and why he's there. And he almost gets away with it. He almost gets away with not being killed by Nexus, at least that right. body not being killed by Nexus.
Right.
Nexus is smart enough to figure it out. Then we get into another storyline where he's so sick of having to do this. He tries to stop and almost destroys himself because he realizes what he's doing, and he's trying to alleviate it. He's trying to understand it. He's trying to justify it all the time. And it's what's going on inside his head, which it's a great comic book, man.
Yeah. And obviously the patrons are horrified by this. Somebody throws I don't know where they got a whole tomato, maybe from the kitchen. I don't know. And throws it in the back of his head.
Yeah, some monument as a tomato. Yeah.
You know, and he lets that go, heads out. And
look at the design of the doorway.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great. It's not just a rectangle,
It's a different shape, incredible dimension, and there's sliding panels you can see inside. Wow.
Yeah, yeah, they're sliding open and will then slide closed again, yeah.
But then there's a little bit of redemption at the end.
Yes.
Nexus saves one of the kids. Tony says, they say sometimes you save people. Nexus replies, who says? Tony says, people. Can I come? And there's this beautiful panel that the kid is sitting there.
Yeah.
His ankles are crossed, his elbows are on his knees, and there are birds flying around behind the kid whose skin is a light brown. He's wearing an orange, dark orange top with light orange highlights, and his trousers are black with orange stripes, light orange stripes, matching the highlights. Behind him, it's yellow with a sort of gold tan across the top.
Yeah.
And these birds, these silhouetted birds, it's just a lovely little thing. And you get right away, I think you can see this kid really does feel bad. He really wants to be saved. He needs to be saved.
Yeah.
And Nexus does. Nexus brings him back to Ilum.
And it's the same kid who, he was brought in as a recruit, I think, correct? Weren't they trying to recruit him? And Teenager blasts the top of his hair off. Sears his hair off. So
he's got sort of like this, his afro shaped into like three or four little puffball mullet.
Yeah, like knots,
Mohawk.
Yeah.
And he gets blasted by Teen Angel to show how tough he is. But Tony shows up many issues later. He's fitted with some other orphans on Ilum. They form a little band.
Oh, very good. So, it's and then the last page, you have the flying heads going by and scaring Tyrone, which is great.
And did you notice one more detail that I want to mention about a character development and what Rude does?
Mm-hmm.
Did you take a close look at Tyrone's feet?
No, I see they're he has a prosthetic foot. Yeah.
He has no left foot. He has a little rocket there to keep his balance.
Oh, okay. Oh, it looks like a prosthetic foot. Okay. Yes, I see it in this other page. Yeah. Oh, very interesting. Just like a little unique touch to...
Exactly. If you look, it's much better on page 3. We first see him, but it's not mentioned. It's not talked.
I did not notice
it's
that at
just
all.
A little touch. He's a survivor. He was in some sort of war or something.
Sure. Yeah. No. That's awesome. That's again, the little touches. The little touches.
The characters in these stories. It's terrific.
I know. It's wonderful. I'm really glad again that you chose somebody because. Look, I love all the characters we've covered so far on this show, but this is a very unique case. You know, somebody sort of outside the realm of Marvel or DC, which I love very much, but something I'm not as familiar with, which is cool because sort of discovering this character or really learning more about him and just how unique he was. Because look, you know, like you said, a lot of the guys that were working in Marvel and DC went on in the 80s to a lot of these independent publishers so they could have a little more freedom, do their own thing. And you can tell, I mean, it comes out in every page that Steve Rood loved doing this book.
Yeah.
He had to have loved doing this book.
Creation, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And
his vision is absolutely clear about what everything looks like, what he wanted to be.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It's great storytelling, facial expression, body poses, movements. I don't want to say cartoony at its finest. It almost seems like it diminishes it, but in a lot of ways it is. It's just such great stuff. I love it. I love it. So how long is Nexus like currently being published in any way? Or
no idea.
I don't know what happened to Nexus. When did I stop? Because it wasn't long after, it was within 2 or 3 years that I really cut back buying comics, and then I stopped reading comics, and then I was out, Jack, keeping my old ones and really loving the old ones. When did I stop Series Galley? Thank you, Mike's Amazing World of Comics. It's just one of the best website ever invented. So issue number 80, date May 1991, was the last first issue, first comics published. But I didn't last that long. Looks like 47, 48. I think I got those. So I didn't even make it to 50 because I was just out of it. At that point, I was out of
the habit. You gave up on 48? You didn't at least go to 50? What?
Well, part of it because I was out of the habit of getting comics.
Gotcha.
Was 40,
gotcha.
April of 88. Okay, yeah. I was living with my two friends then, and they both worked in a comic shop. So they were bringing comics home. So I was reading them. I didn't have to go get them. I was working for a college at the time, so I was traveling a lot. I was on the road a lot. And then the month before that, I met the woman who is now my wife. So then I started, I had a very busy summer. It wasn't time to go to the comic book shop as much as it used to be.
She didn't want you to pick up Nexus 49 or anything like that. It wasn't wrapped in a bouquet of flowers or something.
She
like
didn't
that.
Mind my reading Love and Rockets and Cerberus. I kept with those for a long time.
Yeah, Love and Rockets. Yeah, that's one of the other ones you you mentioned. This issue was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it. It obviously has some dark overtones. And, you know, it's never great to see a child murdered, but, you know.
Right.
He it wasn't like he was going to grow up to be a saint or anything either. So is there anything else you wanted to say about this particular issue?
Oh, plenty, but let's not. Let's. Okay. I strongly recommend Nexus Comics to anyone who enjoys comic books, who likes the superheroic stuff. It's a guy in a mask and a costume with powers. He's fantastic. You like the science fiction stuff. The science fiction is fully realized about other worlds in other races and, or as they're called, sentient beings. If you like fully formed characters in any kind of medium, this is a great story. The overall story of Nexus. Nexus and his friends, Judah and Sundra and Dave, the characters on Ilum, the heads all of his distinct personality. It's absolutely just top-notch, the best stuff.
Yeah, very good, very good, and a kick-ass costume. It is a great costume.
Yeah.
All right, well, Terry, it's last call. So in this segment, I ask my insightful guest Terry some thought-provoking questions that came to me as I prepared for the show. I ask the questions. Terry fascinates us with his answers. Now, as always, I give my guest the first two fantastic questions, and then there is a mystery fantastic question. So, fantastic question number one. Based on characters from smaller publishers, First, Dark Horse, Eclipse, Pacific, Fantagraphics, et cetera, put together your superhero team. And I did not limit the number, so you could be as many or as few as you want.
This is, what an odd question. It's a great question, but it's odd for me because I was going to these other publishers to get away from superheroes. And ironically, well, maybe not ironically, but the way I got to these other publishers was through superheroes from Cerebus the Ironfork, because a friend of mine said, you should read this comic book. I said, why do I want to read a cartoon comic book? I like serious superhero stuff. And he gave me a few issues with the parody character, the Cockroach, who is a parody of that point of Batman and a parody of superhero comics. And I loved it. I always thought it was so funny. So I started buying Cerebus the Aardvark, and then I started buying other stuff, which was not superhero stuff. Parodies of superheroes, yes, but not strictly superheroes.
Yeah.
And also, the other thing is, which I might be an outlier on this, the only superhero stuff I like are DC and Marvel. I had never had any interest in the Red Circle heroes or the other things. Everybody's trying to do their take on essentially Marvel superheroes, on the
right.
Stan Lee kind of superhero. I just was not interested in that. Even writers I admire, like Mark Evanier with DN Agents, never had any interest in reading that stuff. So to put together an independent comic book team of superheroes right. is a challenge. But I think yeah. I got a little handful here.
Okay.
I'm going to start with Aardvark Vanaheim. Cerebus is not on the team. Cerebus is not a team player. He does not belong on a superhero team. But the Moon Roach does. The Moon Roach, I don't know what his powers are. He's crazy. He's strong. He's dedicated. He's easily manipulated, so he'd do good under leadership. And book that started at Aardvark Vanaheim, then moved to Renegade Press by the great Jim Valentino, then known just as Valentino, Normal Man. Have you read Normal Man?
Oh, right? I have not read it. I remember the character. I have not read it, though. No.
The best parody of not just superheroes, of comic books. It started out as a parody of, the first issue was a parody of DC heroes. From DC from the early 60s. Hmm. Second issue is a parody of Marvel from the mid-60s. Then there are parodies of Gold Key comics, parodies of Classic Illustrated, parody, wow. The parody combination Mickey Mouse and Richie Rich was called Mickey Money. Terrific, terrific stuff. Love, you know, it's a lovingly told. So from that series of Normal Man, Captain Everything is on the team. Right. Captain Everything's power was that he came up with a superpower depending on what the situation needed.
Who was publishing that?
That was Aardvark Vanaheim.
That was Aardvark, okay.
It was Normal Man's best friend.
Okay.
When Normal Man was sent from his home planet to Earth, then his home planet didn't blow up. He became that wasn't Earth. He became the only being on that planet that did not have superpowers.
Okay.
He was rescued from his rocket by Captain Everything.
All right, very good.
So he's bright. From First Comics, I would think Nexus is a great character. He's a great superhero kind of guy. Not really someone who belongs on a team, especially this team of misfits. But his friend Judah the Hammer, who sort of looks like an ape, but he's much more in depth. That he gets his power from the heads. He saved a bunch of heads. So they use their their telekinetic kinetic powers to power his sword. And he refers to himself as an independent adjudicator, which is a really fancy name for vigilante. Vigilante is the word I'm looking for. You are guilty. I'm going to hit you. So Judah's on the team. And of course, also from First Comics, although he started at Charlton Comics, E-Man.
Okay, yes. Yes, I know
He's
E-Man.
A lot of fun. From Eclipse Comics, I didn't buy any Eclipse comics. I didn't buy many. This, again, how many comics can one person buy? You can't read all of them. Destroyer Duck. I did get the first issue of Destroyer Duck. So let's put him on the team.
Very good.
They also had characters that fascinated me, but I never bought. I wish, I'd like to now get back and find some affordable copies. Stuff like Air Boy.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that was Chuck Dixon, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Is that Chuck Dixon? Yeah.
Masked Man, which has looked like a spirit homage kind of thing,
okay,
by B.C. Boyer. It's Zot. I never read Zot. It looked great, by Scott McCloud.
Yes. Yeah. No, I never read that either.
I loved it, but I never got around to reading it. So, Steve Englehart and Marshall Rogers' character, Scorpio Rose, another one. I love these characters, these creators. I should buy that comic, but I haven't got another $1.75 to spend for another comic. And to round out the team, from Fantagraphics, from my beloved Love and Rockets, I don't think any of Beto's characters are superhero worthy to be on a team.
Okay.
But Jaime has a couple, I think. Maybe both. First of all, Penny Century, a friend of Maggie and Hopi's. Penny always wanted to be a superhero. So I think if we're getting all these characters together, maybe the combination of maybe Captain Everything can develop the superpower of giving someone else superpowers, or maybe Judah can get the heads to help Penny get some. She's a delightful character.
Well, she could probably keep up with Normal, right?
She could keep up with him.
Yeah,
he couldn't keep up with her. No man could keep up with Penny.
Oh, all right, very good.
And Rena Titanian. If you've never read Love and Rockets, if you only have one thing to read, oh God, you should read Love and Rockets, man. But one of Jaime's early stories, he did this wonderful extended storyline where he split up his main characters, Maggie and Hopi. Maggie got a job in another country, and she had some adventures there, and she met Rena Titanian. It's just absolutely magnificent beautiful. It's storyboard. I don't know why no one's made a movie out of this. Make a movie exactly as it's drawn, including the sequence that's completely in the dark. It's great. It's retro futuristic science fiction. So there are no cell phones,
right.
But there are, you know, flying, cool looking 50s era designed flying car kind of things that look awesome. And, you know, sleeping dinosaurs and stuff. But Rena Titanian was a lady wrestler who sort of became a secret agent around the world, having almost real life superhero adventures. So she'd be a tough girl. She'd probably be the leader of that group. I want to give one more, the comic I never read from Comico Publishers, Mage.
Yes, that, you know, I was going to mention that one. That was the one with a guy. I don't know anything about it other than the pictures. And again, the comic shop, I would help out sometimes. Mm-hmm. He would give me a lot of the old posters, like the promotional posters and stuff like that. And I had one of made. That's the one where it's a guy in like a black t-shirt that kind of looks like a Shazam bolt across his chest. Yeah. Yeah. And it has a beard. Looks like just a regular guy in a t-shirt with a lightning bolt on it.
But again, I wanted to. I was interested, but
yeah,
if someone had given me a couple issues, I probably would have done it, you know?
Yeah.
But I didn't have a couple issues.
Yeah.
There was
so much
stuff being published back then. Great stories and great. It was what I like about this medium. I like the comic medium. I love the combination of illustration and words.
Yeah.
And people like Steve Rude and Jaime Hernandez, they can put so much into a single panel and at the same time leave out any excessive line that no words are needed at all. And the good writers like Mike Barron can write their balloons and their caption boxes with so few words that get across exactly what needs to get across. That's an art, and it's,
yes,
I love it.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And they clearly work very, very well together. All right. Well, that is a fascinating team, and it would be interesting to see them all thrown together and see what would happen. There'd probably be some good stories in that. All right. So, fantastic question number two, and this lends more to the other thing we all know about you. And name your five favorite bands. And I'm not talking about the five best bands or anything, but your personal five favorite bands.
I had to sort of make my own criteria for this. So many things.
Yeah, it's a big, there's a lot.
So, I mean, I leave out things like the Duke Ellington Orchestra because members came and went. Same thing, even something like the Louis Armstrong Hot Five, Hot Seven. People come and go. It's not the band. So think in terms of a band. Mm-hmm. Everything starts mostly with this stuff, and especially for me, with the Beatles. Beatles were the first band that I knew of as a band. It's the four guys. It's them making the music. They're writing the songs. They're singing the harmonies. I read somewhere, some made a great description. You could take those four guys, and they would be the best backing band for someone else. Or they could just put them in a room, and they could write songs for someone else. Mm-hmm. Or you could hire them to be your singing backing trio. They could do it all, and they did everything in just a few years. And so that's where it starts with bands.
Yeah, they basically had like a 10-year run. That was, you know, they're basically like, well, yeah, from actually, you're right, a little less than it, from like, what, 62 to 70, basically, before they broke up. I just real quick on the Beatles. I discovered them sort of in reverse when I started digging through my parents' LPs when I was like maybe 12, 13, something like that. I saw Abbey Road. Mm-hmm. And I think actually Let It Be was the last album they released, but I think Abbey Road was the last album they recorded.
Correct.
I think, yeah. So Abbey Road was the first Beatles album I listened to. And then I sort of like found them in reverse. And then when I would listen to like the early stuff, at that point when I was still listening to like Let It Be and Abbey Road, and, you know, and back that way, Sergeant Pepper and stuff like that, I would listen to the early stuff and I was like, man, this is too bubblegum, this is too pop and everything. But it took me a while. And then when I got down to that, you know, then I get down to like Revolver and Rubber Soul and stuff. So I'd start getting right to the edge of before they, you know, and then I started listening to the early stuff and I'm like, oh my God, this stuff's amazing. You know, the beats, this, everything. So it's kind of funny. That's where I sort of, that's how I kind of discovered the Beatles in like reverse, you know, starting at like 1970 and working back to like 62. But I love them too. So sorry, I digress. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Terrific. Next band for me, because I'm a saxophone player. So when I started playing saxophone in high school, started hanging out with older guys in the band and listening to what they were talking about. So I got into the band Chicago.
Oh, they, yes.
Three-piece horn section with Walter Parizader on sax and trumpet and trombone. And I really got into them big time in high school. I don't like everything they ever did, but those first nine albums.
I was going to ask if there was a particular period in that because they've been around for a long time and they did a million albums and everything like that.
A lot of guys have come and gone. I mean, they lost their guitar player through accidental suicide. Mm-hmm. The bass player left. They fired the drummer. Mm-hmm. I think Walter is retired. Last I read, so I don't sure if Lee, the trumpet player, and James, the trombone player, still in the band. I think must be Bobby Lamb on piano still. So it's not exactly the same band anymore. But
right.
from the 1968 to 1979, I loved Chicago. The next band, those were easy to think about. Then I had to really think hard. Who influences me? But in terms of a band, it's Madness. Freaking love Madness. Yeah. They got a sax player. And
okay.
And I only realized like last year that I've been ripping him off for so long. A lot of my sax playing stuff is from Lee, from Madness. I love his stuff. I love their music. I love their songs are so tuneful and fun and upbeat. And they're just wicked. And their videos are the best. And I got to see them last year. My wife and my daughter and I all went to see Madness, had a great time. So Madness is one of the top bands for me.
What kind of venue did you see them at?
It was at the MGM Music Hall in Boston. It's a new venue attached to Fenway Park, holds 500-700 seats. So it's got
is
a big
like stage. Is it outdoors? Is it like
no, it's indoors.
It's indoor, okay.
Yeah. I didn't want to do overwhelmed with just British. A lot more British folks than all the American music that I like, which is a lot. And I figured out which band it is, the MGs, Booker T and the MGs.
Oh.
But the MGs are the band that played on all the Otis Redding songs. They played on all those early Wilson Pickett records, Sam and Dave, those four guys, with the addition of the Memphis Horns to make it even better, which leaves the fifth band. And I wanted to be parochial about this. I wanted to be, because I have a lot of friends. So I want to mention some of my friends in their bands, Dogmatics, my pals. Dogmatics are label mates. They're on Rumbar Records, as is Spackles. They're on Rumbar Records.
Okay.
The Spackles. Love the Spackles. They're my pals. Girl with a Hawk. That's a great band. Love them.
That's a great name.
The Chelsea Curve. My friends up in Maine, Tiger Bomb. So I'm going to give it to a Boston band. It's my fifth band.
Mm-hmm.
Scruffy the Cat. Long gone. They came out of the Boston punk scene. They're a little bit more than just punk. They had, it's guitar, bass, and drums, but also a little bit of organ and sometimes accordion. Just more fun, up-tempo, melodic, catchy, good tunes with high energy. And that's the kind of music that I play. That's the kind of music that I like.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, that is certainly an eclectic group. All right, here's your mystery fantastic question. You ready?
I'm okay. Ready.
All right. It's not bad. It's nothing bad.
Lasso of Truth, is it?
Yeah, and Martin Gray will be. No, it's not a Lasso of Truth. You don't have to tell me.
Okay, Martin, you can turn it off. They can ask the sports question.
I'm not asking a sports question, Martin. You can keep listening. Tell me something that you love about the modern comic book industry. Now, this could be a creator, it could be a series, it could be a trend, it could be a storyline, it could be anything. Just tell me something you love about today's cover, like in the last like 5-10 years,
okay.
Something that you've enjoyed.
I don't actively collect comics anymore, and I'm not really hip on what's going on in the modern comic scene. However, what's going on that I do like is essentially a throwback. DC is republishing the Treasury editions.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's the only thing I've bought
recently.
Yeah.
Which ones have you bought?
What did I get? I got the Untold Legend of the Batman, even though I have the original three comics when they came out in 1978.
Right. And one just came out very recently, correct?
This year, this last spring. Yeah. And I got the reprint of the Batman Limited Collector's Edition number, 1, 2, 3, whatever it was. One of the very first Treasuries published in 1974.
Yes. Yeah.
Stories.
Yeah.
The Jim Aparo cover looks awesome until you look very carefully at the right leg of Batman, and it's not quite in proportion.
Oh, really?
Once you notice, you can't help but see.
You can't unnotice it, yeah.
And I still want to get out and get the Superman versus Flash, because I never got that one. That was published. I don't need another edition of Superman versus Muhammad Ali. I've got that.
Yeah.
It's in good
condition. Can I give you a hot take about Superman versus Muhammad Ali? I don't like it.
Oh, really?
I think the art's terrific and everything, but I found it weird that they would have this thing where they would just have somebody beat their most prized character to a bloody pulp in the middle of the story. And I know that, I guess the story is that Ali, you know, was like, hey, I have to win,
exactly.
You know, and I get this. But it was almost like they went out of their way to humiliate the character of Superman, which I was just like, I don't know. I just at the time, it probably came out like when I was an infant, I guess. But but I was just like, I don't know. This doesn't do it for me. I've never grasped onto it as this great thing. That doesn't. Yeah, everybody can have their own opinion on it. I know a lot of people love it, but that's always been my opinion of it. I just didn't like the fact that they kind of did that.
In defense of that, it was a plot point. That was Superman's plan.
Yeah, it was, but I mean, to an extent. But I don't know if he knew he was going to get
the outside influence of. We're going to do a story, and do you want to be in it? Yes, I want to be in it, but this is what you have to do. I'm telling you how to write the story, even though you're the story writer.
Yeah.
So, they shoehorned it in nicely. Yeah.
Anyway, I'm sorry. I digress. No.
That's all I know about what's going on in modern comics.
Well, you know, that's a good thing, and they're doing a lot. I think they've done a good job. I think DC is doing a good job of moving forward with certain characters and spreading out offering a bigger tent. You know, not everybody is just, you know, not every hero is just a straight white guy or something like that. But they're also, they're not forgetting, you know, reprinting the Treasuries, the facsimile editions of both Treasuries and regular older comics, as well as these, what is it, DC Finest, I think they're called. They're doing the collections.
I don't know. They've been repackaging material for the last 45 years. That's... Yeah.
But I mean, these particular, they're doing sort of more, I guess, like cost friendly editions and things like that, and then sort of redoing these again and stuff like that. So I think they're doing a nice job of bringing in older readers without alienating newer readers, or vice versa, whatever. However,
that's,
you want to.
That's something that I do want to bring up. That's something that, because twice in the last month, I have seen comic books for sale, not in comic book stores.
Really?
At convenience stores. They're, you know, the quick mark that's attached to the gas station. Mm-hmm. You go in and get the gas. Oh, I'll get something to drink as well. Or I need a gallon of milk. Those kind of places.
Yeah.
At least DC Comics has got a special display box with DC Comics for sale. They're $3, $2.99. I don't know how many, if it's one comic or more comics. We're comic book fans are not.
Yes.
Most of the about comic books is they're selling to the fans. They're not selling to everybody anymore like they used to, but they can't. I understand that. So good for anyone, any publisher who gets their material out into the public.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Get in front of as many people as you can. That's how you, like you said, you're running in to get gas and you're going on a trip. You got kids in the car or something like that. Grab some comics.
Go get a comic.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's great.
Can I have this one? I'll get you that one instead.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, good. Well, I'm glad there's something out there now that's held your interest in bringing you back in a little bit. That's nice. That's nice. Not that you were ever out, you know, but something new, something you can actually go out and buy that's new.
Listening to these podcasts, mm-hmm. sharing these podcasts, being part of these podcasts, talking with you and Rob and Shag and Ryan and everybody else. And Billy, I've talked with Billy several times because Billy's putting like 15 podcasts a day. Billy Delicious over there.
Oh, okay.
You know, mostly I'm talking about the old comics, but I love the enthusiasm that all of the hosts still have. I really, really love that. I admire it. I'm a little jealous that you guys are still out there buying stuff. Dr. Ange has got his pull list every Wednesday. Good for you, Dr. Ange. I'm so happy for that.
Yeah, he does. I still have a comic store in Vienna, Virginia that I go to. Okay. And I take my kids. I take my two boys. I take over there when I go now. And that's kind of the fun thing about it. Basically, I wait till I can take them with me. I never, you know, it could be easier just to run out there, like, you know, during the day or something when they're at school. But I'm like, no, I want them to come. And my
daughter, when she was young too, let's go.
Yeah. And they love it. It's cool. You know, and they
stick to the dollar box.
Yeah. Well, yes. Keep the cheap stuff, guys. But yeah, they have the way the comics store is laid out. There's kind of a little area with a rug that has a kids section, so they can just kind of sit there and thumb through some stuff. And you know, I always buy something for them. You don't want them there. I don't want them, you know, I know it's not a library, but it's cool. And there's a lot of stuff out there for younger readers, which is nice too. So
that is nice.
Yeah, it is.
Get him in. Get him hooked.
I'm trying. My youngest is definitely, he's really into it. He's into the comics and the cartoons and the Legos and all, and, you know, everything. He kind of creates his own Marvel and DC characters that he doesn't have out of the Legos and stuff like that. You know, kind of mix and matches the Lego characters. So it's a lot of fun, yeah. Well, go ahead.
I want to go to a comic book store. I literally don't have the time.
Do you have some nearby you?
Not really. No. They're nearby, but they're not on my way. The last time I was at a comic book store is because I was someplace and I had, okay, I'm here for this thing, and then I have to wait 2 hours. And, oh, wait a second, I know where I am. If I just go a mile from here, because I still know where they are.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Terry, it's closing time.
The chairs up on the tables again.
Yeah, they're putting the chairs up. They're putting the caps over the bottles so we don't get fruit flies. You know, they're putting the cellophane wrap over all the mixtures and everything like that. You know, throwing out the old fruit. You got to do that at the end of the night. Sanitary, can't keep that stuff. If you're at a bar and you ever see them wrapping up the limes and stuff like that, don't go back there because that stuff needs to be thrown out at the end of the night. So anyway. Yes, it is closing time. And Terry, I can't thank you enough for being on the show. This was a lot of fun, and it was great learning more about Nexus, which again I didn't know a lot about, and it was a lot of fun. It's a fascinating character.
It is.
Yeah.
Read Nexus.
I will read more of it.
For folks, you guys who are going to comic book shops, mm-hmm. take a look in the long boxes under the tables. Look for stuff that's not Marvel and DC. See, it's hiding in there someplace. It's hard to categorize it. They're not going to have the first comics section. Maybe it's going to be in the ends. Maybe it's not. Maybe they do put it someplace else. So take a look around. Find something. Take a chance on one of these old stories.
Well, do you want to tell us where can listeners find you?
I can be found. I play in a band called Stop Calling Me Frank. You can find our material from Rumbar Records. We're on Bandcamp. And I'm told we are on other places too, all your favorite streaming devices, the stuff on YouTube, you know, stuff of just the music, stuff that from our stupid videos, which are funny, I hope. And we have CDs for sale. We have T-shirts for sale if you contact one of us or just come to a show. I know Brett's got a pretty good, when these episodes come out pretty regularly, so by the time this is out, I think our latest single should be out. It's coming out at the end of September. However, it's not really a universal appeal song. It's an ode to my favorite grocery store here in Northeast Massachusetts, the Market Basket. It's our
Market Basket. Very good.
Yeah. It's sort of like if you wrote a song for the Wawa.
Oh, God. Well, God. Who wouldn't write a song for the Wawa? Come on.
It's got its own little cult, and I've written a song for it, and it gets a great reaction from our audiences. And of course, we'll have our regular Christmas time song coming out in December. So
December,
or go listen to an old Christmas time song.
All right. I love Christmas songs. So I will definitely listen to it.
Oh, yeah, yeah, listen to Some Kind of Christmas or Say It Ain't So Santa or our favorite, Santa Buy Me a Beer.
All right. Well, maybe next time you're at the Fantastic Lounge, Santa will buy you a beer if you're here closer to the holidays. You never know. Yeah. And you may hear a little bit of Stop Calling Me Frank if you listen through the rest of the episode after feedback. I think they are our house band this week, so they will be playing. They will be playing us out at the end of the episode, too. So don't forget about that. Thanks again for being on the show, Terry. And we will be right back.
Santa, who's there?
Hyperion to a satyr.
Follow Siskoid's deep scene-by-scene dive into adaptations of Shakespeare's Hamlet on Hyperion to a Satyr, the Fire and Water Network's Hamlet podcast. To listen or not to listen isn't the question, as you well know. Kenneth Branagh, Derek Jacobi, Mel Gibson, Laurence Olivier, Ethan Hawke, David Tennant, Classics Illustrated, and many more covered every episode at fireandwaterpodcast.com or where you usually get your podcasts.
And we're back. If you liked what you've heard, support the Fire and Water Podcast Network on Patreon at patreon.com/FW podcast. There you can unlock various rewards, including being name checked on the show of your choice. My fellow network all-star Sean Ross has chosen the Fantastic Four. I'm very excited about this. And, you know, much like how a Nexus has to be submerged in a tank to discover his mission to stop killers, Sean actually submerges himself in an above-ground pool to continue his unshakable mission to destroy anyone who uses the word irregardless. So, if you, dear listener, choose the Fantastic Four, I will get you a free tryout with the Killer Poodles. Or at least I'll find some fun way to mention your name on every episode. Now, here's the feedback for Episode 9 with Ryan Daly, featuring G.I. Joe and a bourbon cocktail. That episode's very guest, FW All-Star Ryan Daly, says, "Still hung over from this episode." Yeah, that was there was some stiff drinks. I kind of was feeling that too, Ryan. FW All-Star Chris Franklin, who's doing House of Frankenstein right now with his wife Cindy, says, "Hey, did someone mention my name? Bourbon County is the next county over for me. I pass through it on my commute to work every day. My sister and ex-brother-in-law worked for Buffalo Trace in Frankfurt for years. You guys were thematically in my backyard, and yet I don't drink. Weird, I know." He continues, "Great discussion on the Joe comics and toys. I bought the comics sporadically, so I really need to get the collections or reread them through at least the good period. The toys were another matter. I resisted G.I. Joe for the first few years because I wasn't much of an army guy as far as toys went. But when the first TV miniseries hit, I ran out and bought Zartan, Duke, and Blowtorch. My friends and I started buying the figures and picking who would always play whose characters. We did the same thing with, I think, Masters of the Universe. So that's the He-Man stuff. Superpowers, Secret Wars, Transformers, Mask, etc. We try not to duplicate each other's figures. We'd ask for different toys and vehicles and stuff for Christmas and birthdays. Because of this, my collection was missing a few important figures. I dropped out of playing in 87, 88. My last Joe was Hit and Run, a rare callback to an actual military-looking figure at the time. I stupidly sold all but my very favorite Joe and Transformer figures at a yard sale my mom had not long after. I could go on, but needless to say, I started collecting toys soon after that, 1989, the year of the bat. My son played with my Joes and the ones that came out around the 25th anniversary releases in the movies. I don't have as an impressive collection as Ryan, but I buy the classified figures I like best, and I have bought some of my favorite vintage Joes and vehicles back when they were lost or broken, like the Sky Striker I picked up at a toy show last month. Funny that Ryan mentioned losing barbecue's nozzle gun in the car. My mom repeatedly warned me, don't open them in the car, you'll lose all the guns. Needless to say, I love this episode, Yo Joe." And Ryan replied to Chris's comment saying the Hit and Run is coming to the classified line in early 2026. Over there enjoying the happy hour in the corner, Super Captain says, "I don't read a lot of comics, but I was a big fan of the action figures and cartoon. Also, despite the impracticality of a shirtless and shoeless soldier, Quick Kick was a favorite, along with Gung Ho, Flash, and Spirit. As far as Cobra characters, my favorite is the Baroness. My wife grew up as an army brat and was also a big fan of the cartoon. Despite her resemblance to the Baroness, Scarlet is her favorite. Ryan Daly also replied to that one. Apparently, he's taken over my show. To Super Captain saying, I didn't give enough praise to Gung Ho, but he's one of my favorites too. Probably my favorite character in the cartoon, either he or Spirit. Godfather Rob Kelly says, this was a really charming episode. Even though the G.I. Joe toy line holds no emotional attachment on me, I never had them, never played with them. And other than the first two issues of the comic, the debut issue was a treasury, so I had to get it. I never read any of that either. But this was like two overgrown kids playing with their beloved action figures while sneaking sips from their parents' booze cabinet. Yeah, it kind of was like that. Having not read the comic, I can only go by what I've heard, but it sounds like G.I. Joe under Larry Hama was the best example anyone could ask for when it came to a capital A art being made from a purely mercenary commercial enterprise. Marvel generally seemed better at that than DC when it came to comic books series that adapted from toys. I would agree with that, Rob. He seemed to get a lot of himself, or at least a decent amount of the authentic creative inspiration, into a series that was published just to sell toys. Finally, I've come to enjoy the sports talk simply because it's a reflection of my waning but still potent influence on the network. And then he says, go Joe. Rob, it's yo Joe, but I'll let that slide. Thanks, Rob. Fantastic Lounge regular Paul Kien sipping a rum punch over in the corner. Love this episode. Not a surprise in general since I love the show, but a surprise since I am a little older and never had the 80s Joes or watched the show or read more than an issue or two of the comic. I did have a 70s Kung Fu grip, though. I really love the stories of your kids playing with your action figures. We have a similar set of Jersey Shore action figures for my kids. They played with all kinds of superheroes on the beach. Love it. And by coincidence, for the few people who want to know more about Mike Vosburgh, check out DC Special Cast in September. Plug, plug. There you go. You're always selling. Robin, Ryan and I actually both replied to Paul's, because when he said Jersey Shore action figures, we thought he actually meant that from like the reality show, the Jersey Shore, like he had action figures of that. But he was just meant that he was buying figures for his kids at the Jersey Shore. So anyway. Over at the foretop by the band, Edo Boznar says, enjoyed the show, even though, like Rob, I was never really into G.I. Joe, neither the toys or the comics. I bought the first issue, decided it wasn't for me, and never looked back. However, I can say something about Mike Vosburgh, and I'm not encroaching on Paul's territory or ruining his upcoming show. Mainly, I just wanted to note he's a solid artist, but you can always see the difference when he was doing work for a paycheck as opposed to something he really liked. So his art in, say, the first She-Hulk series or in G.I. Joe, based on your gallery page, reflects the former. It's all perfectly fine, but entirely workmanlike and unremarkable. However, his work in the Sword and Planet series Starfire from the late 70s or in the Marvel Epic series Sisterhood of Steel is quite striking. In both cases, he was really into the projects. I think he has a co-creator status on both. Thanks, Edo. I didn't know that. I'll have to check that out. Asking for Sambuca in his coffee, Dr. Ange says, great episodes. I bought the G.I. Joe comic for about the first year. I was lured in by a couple things. A snazzy number one on Baxter paper, pretty good cartoon, and those commercials where you got to see comic cover at the end. Comics on TV, incredible. But after that, I just don't think it was for me. Hearing you both talk about the subsequent storylines with Machinations and Cobra, Eternal Squabbling made me wonder if I missed something. You should check it out, Ange. You might like it. As for Vosburgh, I know him mostly as someone suited for writing beautiful women. The 70s Starfire, as we mentioned, as well as the second volume of American Flag when Chaykin returned to write. So I didn't know if he was the right artist for this book. And Ange followed up with, a couple other things. Bears aren't going anywhere this year, and neither are their Pats. That's when Ryan and I got in a little Bears talk at the end there, some football talk. And I'd be Dr. Mayhem, a field surgeon, but with a berserker fighting style when provoked. Old school bayonet would be my weapon of choice. Jeez, Ange, going primal there. Getting carted at the door, Bucky749 says, what comics do you think some Joes and Cobras read in their spare time? I don't know, Richie Rich, I guess. And if the Howling Commandos, G.I. Joe, and Invaders joined forces for a big team-up, who would you choose to represent each team, and what big mission would you send them on, and who would be the big bad guys? I take Dum Dum, Dugan, Gung Ho, and Toro, and they'd fight Croc Master and that dominatrix lady from the Invaders, I guess. To answer questions, if I was to join the Joe, codename King Dragon, special skills, hand-to-hand combat, proficient in all NATO small arms, very good, and master of bladed weapons and pole weapons. Reading the menu, first-timer David Ace Gutierrez says, yes, CoverGirl is my favorite Joe, and the Wolverine is my all-time favorite vehicle. I don't know why, but it may have something to do with her former job. Great episode, guys. Thank you, Dave. Just standing by the jukebox being great. Nate the Great says, never got any of the G.I. Joe figures, but did read the comics and watch the cartoons. Also, like that second movie with The Rock and Bruce Willis, kind of like Snake Eyes, Shipwreck, and Baroness. Am I the only one that wondered if Cobra Commander and Cobra were the same guy, just different companies and costumes? You're probably right on that, Nate. From social media, I believe it's pronounced Stibe, says, I finally caught up with all your Fantastic Four episodes. They were so much fun. I especially liked G.I. Joe episode because I'm a lifelong Real American Hero fan. But every single one was enjoyable to listen to, and I'm looking forward to this one. I like Cocktails Connection as well. I was hoping to make the drink and read the comic after listening. So far, I've only made the rum punch, and it was tasty. Thank you, John. That's awesome to hear, and I'm glad you're playing along. Finally, my new Patreon name check, Sean Ross, host of Peacebound and Down, One Warm podcast, and ordering a flirtini at the bar. Jeez, Sean. Anyway, he says, this episode hit me where I live. G.I. Joe 10 through 67 was one of my favorite runs ever. Zooming in on issue 16 was a smart choice. Captured a lot of the infighting in Cobra and the danger of the conflict when Hawk is shot. Hama did such a great job of creating excitement and high stakes in the book. Issues often ended on cliffhangers, and the Joes always seemed outgunned. If you're not reading it, I highly recommend the current G.I. Joe book from Skybound imprint from Image. Joshua Williamson is retelling the origin of Cobra and Joes, and it's a great book. I'll have to check that. I haven't checked that out yet, but I'm planning on it. Thank you to all who listen. Be sure to subscribe to Fantastic Four, available in the Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and Spotify. Keith G. Baker, I have figured out Spotify issues, so I'm working on that. Thank you for bringing that to my attention. And, of course, please leave a 5-star review. Fantastic Four is a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. You can find all episodes of Fantastic Four and many other quality shows at fireandwaterpodcast.com. Please leave comments on the website. Let me know what you think of the show. I will read all feedback at the end of every episode. You can follow us at Facebook at FW Podcast Network, Blue Sky at FW Podcast, or use our hashtag online, hashtag FW Podcast. I can be found on Instagram and Blue Sky at Imaginate Design. Thanks again, Ward Hill Terry, for hanging out at the Fantastic Lounge and bringing the band. Stop Calling Me Frank is going to play us out with their original song, My Baby is an Axe Murderer from Wisconsin. Until next time, the bar is open.